So we're in this series called The Best Is Yet to Come. It is the first week of four on the book of Ruth. And the idea that the best is yet to come is this, it's this idea that where we're at in this moment, if it is difficult, it is challenging, if it is painful, if we don't understand, the best is yet to come. And this is where we're going to pick up Ruth. And when we are beginning this story in the book of Ruth, what you have is you have a situation that is hard, that is challenging, that the people are left asking this question of why. But maybe why isn't the best question they could be asking themselves. You know, the book of Ruth is this crazy, involved, nuanced, fast-moving book. The book of Ruth is four chapters long. If you're going to read it from beginning to end, soup to nuts, it'll probably take less than 15 minutes. It's 85 verses. But in those 85 verses, what it accomplishes, where it goes, is pretty incredible. See, Ruth is ultimately a love story. Ruth is kind of like this Cinderella story of this person coming from nothing and finding love. It's also kind of like this Romeo and Juliet type love story of these warring factions. And these factions go back generations of conflict. And yet these people from this place find love. Ruth has death, famine, bad advice, good advice. In chapter 3, 2 weeks from now, you want to come back, there is an attempted seduction. A whole and holy love story. It includes Naomi, who is, for my money, the most hard luck, sort of like sob story in the entire Bible. People tell you this guy Job had the hardest way of it. But Job was at least a man in a man's world. Naomi had a lot of the same things happen to her, but then no chance of sort of building herself back up. It wrestles with huge, important theological and social things. You know, the book of Ruth, it talks about redeem or redeeming or redemption more regularly than any other book of the Bible. It brings up conversations on why God would allow pain and suffering. It stands as a commentary of a patriarchal society that limited women's rights. It addresses self-sacrificial generosity towards the under-resourced and the hungry. And it highlights kindness and generosity, specifically in regards to immigrants and refugees from another country, which is associated with a different religion and a consistent long-term international conflict. But that's not relevant at all in our world. And so what you have is this book that is small, but it's huge. It's this tiny little, beautiful little love story with like a couple very, very important characters in the story. But at the same time, this tiny little love story, as we'll see over the next couple of weeks, has impacted literally billions of lives. So the best is yet to come. Let's start in verse 1. Ruth 1, verse 1. Man, by the way, if you don't have a Bible, if you don't own one, there are some on the shelf back here. And I would ask you, I would beg you, please, take it on your way out. But if you take one, you owe me something. Reading Ruth this week. It'll take 15 minutes. If you take a Bible, you got to read Ruth. It starts on page 160. All right. So Ruth 1:1. But it'll be on the screens behind me. In the days when the judges ruled in Israel, a severe famine came upon the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah left his home and went to live in the country of Moab, taking his wife and his two sons with him. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife was Naomi. Their sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Epaphrathites from Bethlehem in the land of Judah. And when they reached Moab, they settled there. Okay, that's a lot going on. And honestly, at first glance, it's kind of hard to follow along what's happening because there's a lot of people's names and there's a lot of place names. And you get that many names and place names together, it kind of jumbles and runs together. And it becomes difficult to follow what's happening. And so let's just sort of start pulling these things apart and understanding them. So he is from a place, a town called Bethlehem. Bethlehem, the name Bethlehem means house of bread. Now, it says they're Epaphrathites, which means they're from I knew I was going to mess this up. Epaphratha. Ephrath. Thank you. Oh, I knew it. You have no idea how many times I've practiced Ephrath, but I knew. Lights come up, game time. I'm going to say it wrong. It's okay. Ephrath. So they're from Bethlehem, house of bread. Ephrath, which means fruitful. Ephrath is a region, kind of like Merrimack Valley, of the Israel. Israel is known as the land flowing with milk and honey. So what you have is you have this guy, Elimelech, and his wife, Naomi, and their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. And they live in the house of bread in a fruitful region of the land flowing with milk and honey. And they don't have food. And you're like, how is that possible? It seems like if you live in house of bread and fruitful region of land flowing with milk and honey, then you should probably have those things, right? But if you look at the previous book, the book called Judges, several times in Judges, it says that God allows a famine to come to sort of like grab the people by the shoulder and shake them and say, guys, you're messing up. Come back to me. Pursue me. Follow me. Live a life with me. That's the best life for you. And so what you have here is you have, this is happening. And there is a famine in the house of bread in a fruitful region of the land flowing with milk and honey. And so they move to Moab. And maybe we don't understand at first is that Moab is like 30 to 40 miles away. So the equivalent for us would be Logan Airport. It's 34 miles away. And so the idea is that here in North Chelmsford at Harbor of Hope Christian Church, the idea is that there's famine and there's no food and our crops are dying and our livestock is dying and the people are dying. But 34 miles away, like life is good, grass is green, it's raining. And you're like, how is that possible? It's because all along the way, God was trying to get their attention. He was trying to, hey, guys, wake up, return to me, come back to me, walk with me. And this guy, the Elimelech is the guy's name, is the father of the family. And it says that he took his wife and his sons. It was very much feels like he made this decision for everyone. And they went to Moab. Now, Moab is this place that he went to, and Moab is this place that you never go to. Like, you don't go to Moab. Whatever you do, don't go to Moab. Because Moab is this place where the people worship this god Chemosh. And Chemosh was this very, very violent god. And you worship Chemosh, this god, through violent ways. In 2 Kings, it has people sacrificing other people to this god Chemosh. Because it was just this godless place with this god that was violent. And the people were not someone you want to raise your family and your children alongside of. Actually, in Deuteronomy 23:3, it says this, which gives you a sense for like how much you don't go to Moab. And no Amorite or Moabite or any of their descendants for 10 generations may be admitted to the assembly of the Lord. So the idea here is that if you marry someone of Moabite descent or your kid marries someone of Moabite descent, 10 generations down the line are not allowed to worship. Like they really, really had like hard and fast rules around no Moab, like do not overlap. And actually other points in the Bible, it says that there was kind of like some tension or like some chemistry between like Hebrew men and Moabite women. Like there was just kind of like some, they liked each other's, the cut of their jib, or I don't know. Like there was like some tension and chemistry there. And so they wanted to, but then they couldn't. It was like a hard pass, like a hard no. You don't go there. Don't go down that road, right? So you have Elimelech and he goes to Moab. You're like, why would he do that? That doesn't seem to make sense. Especially when you understand what Elimelech's name means. See, Elimelech, the name Elimelech means my God is king. And so you'd assume that this Elimelech guy, when he makes a choice like this, like he would definitely look at what God thought was best. Like he would definitely pursue what God felt like was best for him and his life. He would most definitely pursue what God wanted for him and for his family and for his kids. I mean, think about it from your perspective in your life. Like, if you were going to make a move like this, like how intentional would you be? Like if we move across the same town, we're thinking long and hard about changing the school and the cost of the house and all this. Like it goes, our thought process goes deep into this thing, and for it feels like he just sort of like made this gut call and he took his wife and he took his sons and he went to Moab. At no point did it say. And we'll see in a few verses that God is involved and God is moving. But at no point in this passage does it say Elimelech took time apart, set time aside, and sought God on what God would want for them. There's no even hint or inclination that he said, God, what do you want for me? Like, what do you want? What do you want me to raise my kids? What do you want for me to be married? Like, what's the best thing? Like, what is your best for me in my life? There was no time. There was no talk. There was no, Elimelech, his name means my God is king, but his life said otherwise. And I just want to start by saying that in a room like this with this many people, there are going to be people who are making life decisions, big, some small, but life decisions. And I want to ask you, I want to caution you, I want to encourage you, take the time to see what God has for you. The thing is, like, I get it. As a father, as a husband, like if it's not going well here and 35 miles away, it's like it's raining and the livestock is healthy. Like I would want to move my family. That seems like the best, most convenient thing to do. But if that's not what God has for me, it's the wrong thing to do. You will never regret aligning your life with what God has called you to do. You will never, ever regret living the life God has designed for you. Even if it doesn't make sense, it doesn't add up. 1 + 1 = 3. Just go with it. You will not regret it. You know, I've been on staff here at Harbor now for 11 months. And about, there you go. And 12 months ago, 12 and a half months ago, keep it down in the back. I'm okay with the woo. The whistle was a little questionable. But 12 and a half months ago, I was this place where I didn't know. I knew that God had called me out of something. I had very clearly known that God had called me out of something. But I didn't know that what he had called me to yet. So he had only called me out of and not called me into. And honestly, the truth is, in my heart of hearts, I had such peace because I knew that I was exactly where God had me to be. And that was in limbo. But that's okay because I was in limbo and that's what God wanted me to be. And so there's this moment where a couple months ago, John led us in this talk of imaginative prayer in this series, The Voice of the Father. And I had John do that because John introduced me to imaginative prayer several years ago. But at this moment, about a year ago, when I was in imaginative prayer, and I was just thinking about, I was talking to God, and I was talking to Jesus, and I was like, Jesus, you know, what's my next thing? What should I pursue? What's my next step? What's my next season? And I had talked, I'd spoken to Brian Devereaux from here about this opportunity, but I wasn't sure if that's what God had next, and there was just like in the opening conversations, and I remember, and as I'm talking to Jesus, the only thing he said back to me was, talk to Kelly Tibbetts, our Kelly here, and I was like, actually, funny thing, God, I've never talked to Kelly. And if I start a conversation with, hey, Kelly, I was having imaginative prayer, and it said talk to you, she might think I'm crazy, right? And then plus, like, when you're, like, interviewing for a job or thinking about interviewing for a job, like, there's, like, a way things go. You don't, like, circumvent people. That is not okay. And I was sort of talking to this guy, Brian, and then I felt like I was saying, no, talk to Kelly. And I was like, God, I don't think I should do that because Brian's my point of connection. And he was like, yep, I hear what you're saying. Good point. Talk to Kelly. Okay, I mean, is that... And so I emailed Kelly, and then we sat down at Prest Cafe, and we talked, and we shared our hearts for ministry. And Kelly and I have been in lockstep ever since, you know, and we have worked together so beautifully since. And it started in this moment when it was like, all right, we'll talk to Kelly. And it didn't make sense, and it probably wasn't the strategic thing, and it wasn't like the how when you're interviewing for a job thing, but it was the God thing. Tell another story. So 2 weeks ago, when my wife was on a mission trip to El Mirador, and I was on a mission trip not to yell at my children too much. We talked about that last week. I'm not going to go into that. She was on a mission trip to El Mirador, and she comes back. And all week long, like I at my phone in the notes category, I wrote down everything that happened because if I don't write stuff down, she's going to say, what happened while I was gone? And I'd be like, stuff? And I wouldn't have anything. So I wrote everything down. And so she talked and told me about all the trip and told me what was happening. And then in one of the stories, she says, and then our sponsor girl was going, this was happening. It was so funny. And she goes over here and tells this part. And then I was just listening. But in my mind, I was like, mental note, we don't have a sponsor girl, but let's loop back to that later. And so she's talking and telling me about the trip. And I tell about what was happening while she was gone. And then after we got done with 45 minutes or an hour of just like catching up, I was like, now, about 45 minutes ago, you mentioned our sponsor girl. She's like, oh, you heard that? Yeah, I heard that one. She's like, well, honestly, like I was there and I met the girl and I just really felt this piece about I wanted to sponsor her. I feel like God called us to sponsor her. And I know that we don't always, like if you look at our books, the money might be tight, but I just believe if we walk with God, like he will provide the way. It's only $38 a month, but it means so much more than that to her. And I was like, well, I trust that walking with God is the best thing, and I trust your relationship with him, so I'm so proud of you for doing that. I'm so proud of you for listening and obeying God's leading in your life. We don't have to have the numbers figured out. The number is $38. I mean, we can cut out Starbucks or probably something else, not Starbucks, but we'll cut something out. And we'll get there. We'll make that happen. Because when you walk in alignment with who God has you to be, you'll never regret it. If you live like his name said he should have, that God is king, you'll never regret it. Let's keep reading. In verse 3. Man, we have 85 verses, and we're 2 verses in, so I don't know when you guys are going home. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Okay, by the way, before I go, what I want you to do is I want you to pay attention not to just to what happens in these 4 verses, but what the Bible says as to why it happens. So Elimelech takes Naomi and his 2 sons, and they move from Bethlehem to Moab, and they settle there. And we pick up in verse 3. Then Elimelech died, and Naomi was left with her 2 sons. The 2 sons married Moabite women. By the way, Amber, you're not supposed to do that. One married a woman named Orpah, not Oprah, Orpah. I could see you confuse that. And the other, a woman named Ruth. And about 10 years later, both Mahlon and Chilion died. By the way, the names Mahlon and Chilion, if I'm lying, I'm dying. Their names, Mahlon means sickly, and Chilion means dying. So maybe don't name your 2 sons sick and dying. Just like, just food for thought. This left Naomi alone without her 2 sons or her husband. Then Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had blessed his people in Judah by giving them good crops again. So Naomi and her daughters-in-law got ready to leave Moab to return to their homeland. With her 2 daughters-in-law, she set out from the place where she had been living and took the road that led them back to Judah. And what you have is you have a woman, Naomi, and she has her husband and 2 sons, and they are living now in Moab. And it just says 3 words. It doesn't give us any why. It doesn't give us any context. There's no, he died because of this, or he died because of that, or God did this, or God did that. There's none of that. It just says, and Elimelech died. He gets married Moabite women, and 10 years later, sick and dying, sick, and they die. And you know what's fascinating and what I find so compelling and enthralling about this passage is that's exactly how our lives actually function. Like when we go through times like this, when we go through situations like this one, when we live through seasons where it feels like things are falling apart, where it feels like we don't understand why, and there's never like this booming voice from heaven that says, hey, that thing that was terrible, it happened for this one other. It never happens that way. Like it just says, and Elimelech died. And in our life, it's that exact same way. We're going along, we're living our life, we're doing our best, and she cheats, or and he cheats, or and he leaves, and my kid starts using, and she overdoses, and I lose my job, and we file for bankruptcy. And at no point does it feel like there's a reason, there's a why. And so we ask these existential questions of like, why? Why, God? Why would you allow that? Why would you let this happen? And the Bible, it doesn't even sniff at why. It just says the what. And Elimelech died. 10 years go by. Mahlon and Chilion die. And then you have Naomi, and she has her 2 daughters. And so she says he took the road that led back to Judah. And I picture like her walking this road, and at some point she stops on this road back to Judah. And I picture her like on this road back to Judah, like the last time she walked this road, it was holding her husband's hand, and her kids were like picking on each other behind them, and she's like, stop that, don't make me stop this car. There weren't cars, whatever, you know how it goes. Stop hitting your brother. And this time she's walking, and it's her and her daughters-in-law, but they're not even really her daughters-in-law anymore, Orpah and Ruth. And she stops, and she's like overwhelmed by the moment. And she's realizing she's leading 2 Moabite women back to Judah. Like, there's no life for these women back there. And so she's like, she stops them halfway there, and she says, stop. You guys can't go with me. Don't come with me. Like, we're not going to read this, but it's the next portion. She's like, there's no future for you there. I can't have more sons. Even if I could have more sons now, you wouldn't wait for them. So just go back to your parents. She says, go back to your parents' gods. She says this thing. She says, God has raised his fist to me. why. It doesn't say why at all. And it's this thing that we call an act of God. Like that's super bad branding, like act of God. Like why did this thing happen? It was an act of God. You know what's funny is in between time, when I left my previous church and I started at Harbor, there was like a month and a half where there was no money coming in, and we felt like maybe, just maybe, we'd have enough money sort of like bridge the gap. But we weren't sure, and things would have to go pretty well for us to be able to make it. And I remember having this feeling like every day nothing went wrong. For like a month and a half, nothing broke. The fridge never broke, the oven never broke, the brakes never went, my kids never skinned their knees, had to go to the hospital, like nothing went wrong. I remember having this moment where I was like, oh my goodness, like God's greatness is being shown in the status quo just being maintained. And we never, there are rarely moments when we're like, we go down stairs in the morning to get the OJ out of the fridge, and we open the fridge and we get the OJ out and it's still cold, and you're like, yes, my fridge still works. Act of God. It's never that. Like, we only use those words when it's like a tsunami or we lose our job. Like, why God? Like, we never think in terms of how God is moving constantly. He's constantly moving on our behalf. And we just assume, we're just so accustomed to him moving. It's like a fish not realizing they're wet. He moves on our behalf so often. But it doesn't change the fact that there's this question of why. And really, honestly, I feel like that's the wrong question. I mean, we'll get to why. We'll wrestle with why over time. But what now? Like, when that stuff happens, what now? Like, what steps do we take? What do we hold on to? What do we hang our hat on to? And Romans 8:18 says this. Yet, what we suffer now is nothing. Nothing. I bet in a room like this, we've suffered some pretty horrific stuff. We've seen people die in horrific ways. We've had people walk out on us in horrific ways. We've probably done horrific things. We probably live with the guilt of horrific choices we've made. And God has the tenacity, the gall to call it nothing. You're like, wait, how is that? How is my horrific nothing? He says, what we suffer now is nothing compared to the glory he will reveal to us later. And so you think back on those dark moments when he got sick, when she left. It was horrific. And you think about that and you realize how much more God is going to do in your future. The best is yet to come. All of God's promises are yes and amen. Every single one will come true. In those moments, hold on to one like this. It's nothing compared to what is to come. The question is not why. The question is what's next. The thing I would say, and in those moments when you want to ask why, look where God is showing up in unexpected ways. We're going to go back to Ruth. In Ruth chapter 1, verse 16 and 17, it says this. So this is on the road. And so you have Naomi, and she's walking past to Judah, and she turns around and she says, stop, there's no future with me. Don't go forward. You're Moabites, you were going to Judah. There is no future with you and me in Judah. So just go back to where you're from. And Orpah's like, you know what? Deuces, I'm out. You're right. Good call. Thank you. Peace. No. And so Orpah's like, you're right. Good call. I'm out of here. And then Ruth says this. But Ruth replied, don't ask me to leave you and turn back. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Next slide. Wherever you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord punish me severely if I allow anything but death to separate us. This promise isn't like, hey, we're going to go to town, we're going to find men, it'll be okay. No, 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 it's not like, there's no like, hey, we're going to good about town, we're going to get hooked up. There's no like, I know that's going to get better for us. It's just like, hey, no, no, you don't understand. Like, I'm with you. But did you catch it? Part of what Naomi said to the girls was, go back to your families, go back to your towns, go back to your gods. And Ruth's response was, no, 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 no. I'm with you. I'm with your people. And I am with your God. That's funny. There are moments and times when God pursues people and people feel called to God and you don't really understand why or how it happened, but you know that it happened and people are like returning back to God and it's kind of inexplicable, but it's happening anyway. And that's what's happening here. She's like, I don't know. I don't know what's going on. I'm not going back there. I'm with you. I'm with your people. I am with your God. And it's this moment when you see in the midst of these painful, terrible, horrific things that God shows up and he calls Ruth to himself. And you go even further. And in verse 22, this happens. So Naomi returned from Moab accompanied by her daughter-in-law, Ruth. So now they're in Judah. They walk into town, Naomi and Ruth, and they don't know what's coming down the pipe. They don't know what's coming, but they know that they're in it together. The young Moabite woman. They arrived in Bethlehem in late spring, at the beginning of the barley harvest. That seems like nothing, but it's everything. Because they plant and they water and they toil all year round. And this is the moment when they collect the food and there's more food than enough. There's more than enough to go around and there's more food than people need. And so this is the moment. This is the only moment when they could have walked into town and had a chance to not starve to death. Because there's systems in place that we'll get to in the next coming weeks where people who don't have enough, they can be fed. But it has to happen at this time and only this time of year. And so they walk back into town and it just so happens to be at harvest season. You're like, how is that possible? Like that they walk back into town at the singular only moment when life could have been sustainable. It's because even in the worst moments, God is moving on our behalf. Yes, you walk back into town and you have no shot. But then when you walk into town, it's harvest season and suddenly there's hope. Soren Kierkegaard says it this way. Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards. I imagine in your life, you've probably seen stuff like that. Seen moments when you look back at life and you saw where God moved, but in the moment you couldn't see it. And so the next time you're in one of those moments, you can't see it. Have faith that what you're going through is nothing compared to what he's going to do next. I'm going to close with a story. My older brother, who's no longer with us, his name was Michael, and he was 2 years older than me. You're going to see our picture. That's he and I when we're young. And Michael was 2 years older than me. And Michael ran headlong into an addiction. And he spent the rest of his life trying to get out ahead of it. And he never quite could until the very end. And when Michael was younger than I am now, he got clean. He got sober. He got ahead of alcohol. He had several months clean. And then after a few months of being clean, he had like the flu or pneumonia. He got sick. And so after years and years of alcoholism, he was sick, he had the flu, pneumonia, he took like ibuprofen or Tylenol or something. And that stuff's hard on your liver, similar to how hard alcohol is. And so he took too much. He took like, instead of, he didn't like take the bottle, but he took like four instead of two, and every like 3 hours instead of every 4 hours or whatever. And whatever it was, the ibuprofen, the Tylenol, it shut down his kidneys, and that shut down his liver. And eventually, it couldn't process the ibuprofen in his system, and so it turned it to ammonia. And then that shut down the rest of his body, and he passed. Younger than I am now. And after he passed, the doctor was talking to my mom, and he was just saying, you know, what's odd was when he came in here, he was sick, but he was still conscious, and I have no idea why that was. He's like, what do you mean? He's like, well, the parts per million of ammonia in his system was so high, like he should have been in a coma hours before. Mom's like, really? We just spent like the last like 6-8 hours talking and playing games and telling stories and sharing jokes and talking about good movies we've seen recently. And it was like this last magical, perfect day that Michael and my mom had. And she didn't see it at first. And so I was like, Mom, don't you see? Like God moved on your behalf. Like it was a small thing, but it was a thing. You got that day with Michael that there's no medical explanation as to why you got it. There's no explanation. She's like, you know what? Honestly, in that day, he talked to me a lot about his faith journey and the way he's taken steps on his terms the last few months since getting sober. And it's just like this beautiful, that gave her hope. But she hadn't connected the dots that day was a magical, not a magical, but like a miraculous gift from God. It was like this, it was this thing there was no medical explanation for. And it was this day where she'll always hold on to. Her son talked about his faith journey, and they played games, and they laughed, and they talked about movies, and they told jokes for 8 hours that shouldn't have existed. And I don't know why God took him, this act of God. You know, he'd just gotten sober. Maybe he was going to relapse and have cycles of relapsing. I don't know. But I do know, even in this moment, this why moment, that his hand was there. He was involved. He had not forgotten, and that the best is yet to come. Let's pray. God, I am so thankful for the way that you move on our behalf, and the way that doesn't matter how bad something gets or how bad a season gets, is that we can always rely on the fact that you are good, you have us in the palm of your hands, you have not forgotten us, you love us more than we think is possible, and you will never let us go. That there is nothing that can separate us from your love. Later on that same passage, it talks about the glory that is to come. Later on that same chapter, it says that nothing can separate us from your love. Not even ourselves, not even our poor choices, not even the dark moments of our life. That you love unconditionally. And that in those moments when we feel like you are so distant, you are involved and you are moving. And the question is not why. The question is what's next? Like, what do we do next? What's my next step? God, I don't know the why for Michael. But I know what you did. I know where you are moving. And I know how you gave my mom hope. And I am so thankful for that. So God, I love you. I know that we as a community, we stand before you, and we as a community, we love you. And we don't have time to walk around with a microphone and what's the horrific thing you've lived through? What's the horrific choice you've made? What's the horrific moment that you, but if we did, there'd be terrible stuff. So we as a community, we collectively, we as a family of faith, a family of people pursuing you, we say if your promises are yes and amen, and that the stuff that we've gone through, the horrific stuff we've gone through, is nothing compared to, then what you have in store for us must be beyond words, incredible, indescribable. And so we rely on that. We rely on the fact that you are good, that you have not lost control, and that you love, and that the best is yet to come. We thank you. In your name, amen.